One of my favorite movies of all time was The Great Escape, with Steve McQueen and James Garner. Just a great movie. I'm sure you all agree, right? Well, Don was there. He was in The Great Escape prison, Stalag Luft III. And in his book here, he talks about the differences in the movie and the actual happenings. So and now I'd like Don to talk about that.
Well, thank you. When I wrote the book originally, I poo-pooed what Steve McQueen had done in the movie because I thought it never happened. Well, I had a book at home written by the fellow whose character Steve McQueen played. His name was Jerry Sage. He had an unusual story himself. He was captured in Africa. He was an OSS man, which was a forerunner to the CIA. Sage actually did all of the things that Steve McQueen did, including throwing his baseball over the little guardrail and then walking in where you were liable to be shot immediately if you did so. I had to rewrite that part because I found that all the things that Steve did except the motorcycle ride, which was not a feature of the actual story, was actually done by this fellow Sage, and I recanted and rewrote it so that it reflected credit on him. The thing about the prison camp was that the Great Escape camp was in Western Poland. There were 10,000 flying officers in that one camp, Allied flying officers. How many planes do you think they had to shoot down to get that number? Plus, there were other camps with flying officers. Well, General Bub Clark wrote, and I knew him in the prison camp, he was a colonel then, that there were 10,000 bombers shot down of our bombers and 8,000 fighters. Now, I can't authenticate that for you, but that would show you the type of losses we were suffering. And even though the percentages got better flying, you know, so, well, your chances of getting to 28 missions were fair, but in the early days of 1943, as I found out from talking to prisoners of war who had been shot down in that period of time, the number of missions was less than five before they were shot down, some on their first mission, because they were flying without escorts. The prisoner of war camp was an experience I'll never forget. I have to say that the reason I'm dressed the way I am today is because I still have the mental state of a prisoner who said, never again am I going to be like an animal behind the barbed wire, starving, and living a terrible existence. We were lucky that we did survive, but we had some terrible moments that next winter of January 1945. The Russians were within 20 miles of our camp. We could hear their cannons going off. And so we knew that something was going to happen. Unbeknownst to us, Hitler had ordered we all be marched out of there, which we were, at 15 degrees below zero in a blizzard, with everything we owned on our back. And we marched, I think, 35 miles the first night without stopping, except for we had a little rest period there. And we then marched to a little town called Moscow. We're going west from the camp because the Russians were coming from the east. And we managed to get inside a factory where there was heat. And we were able to take our clothes off for a change and get some relief from the cold. From there, a day and a half later, they marched us out and we went another 10 miles in the cold weather and boarded cattle cars that were built to hold 40 men or 8 horses. Well, you couldn't have both, but a lot of people think that's what it was. They put 50 of us in each one of these cars, and there wasn't room for everybody to sit down at once. At one point, we pulled into Regensburg. I know now what it was. I didn't know then. And the air raid sirens went off. And the German guards locked us in and left. And we didn't know what the target was. Maybe we were sitting in this marshalling yard. Maybe we were the target. We had no knowledge of whether there was any signs. And it was nighttime anyway, so what are you going to do? We waited, and they heard the planes flying over. We heard the bombs dropping in the distance. And then we moved on again from there. That was an experience that you don't want to live through, where you're in the, locked in a cage and you hear an air raid siren go off. We went on from there on the train to Bavaria, to a camp called Stalag 7A. Now, there were already, this camp was built for 40,000 prisoners. When we got there, there were already 100,000. We added another 10,000. By the time we were liberated, it was 130,000. Conditions there were deplorable. It was the worst. We had fleas. We were starving. We lost weight. I think I got down to about 120 pounds. And finally, Patton's Army, on April 29th, 1945, I'll never forget that day as long as I live. The gunfire going on outside of camp, we heard cannon fire, and Patton's 14th Armored Division overran our camp. The Germans fled. We were in shock, most of us. I was in particular, because you don't actually realize, say, how can this be? We're free to go. Patton came into our camp 3 days later, May 2nd, and we stood at attention in our rags, in our awful condition. He said five words to us: "Have you enough to eat?" Well, that wasn't the point, really. It was what we could eat, not if we had enough to eat. And our stomachs were in such condition, we could not eat regular food. I actually went one day, walked down to a mess kitchen run by our army, and they offered us food. We couldn't eat it. Went back to camp and waited for the people to come and get us. Patton, I had my impression of Patton at the time. He had a scowl on his face. And I thought, well, why is he scowling? We're happy. We're liberated. And I read finally in his diary, he said, "What a fine bunch of men." But then I read a speech last year that he gave to his troops before the invasion. And in that speech, he said to his own men, "My men don't surrender. And I don't want to hear about any of you being captured unless you were wounded, and even then I expect you to keep on fighting." So I formed the opinion, as I said originally, that Patton was kind of disdainful of prisoners of war because we must have screwed up or we wouldn't be there. You know? But I forgave him. He was a great general and a great character, and he'd set us free. That was the end of that experience. But I have to say that every prisoner of war who's been to prison for any length of time comes away with post-traumatic stress disorder. I believe that Senator McCain, if he'll forgive me, I believe he's still suffering from his prison imprisonment. We had these thousands of men there in those conditions. It had to affect you. So when I read now about the post-traumatic stress disorder in the troops coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, I believe every bit of it, because in that war, like our war, the shooting came from every direction. You didn't know where it was coming from. You don't know what's coming next. You don't know who the enemy over there is. And that our men are legitimately affected by that. So I express sympathy for them, and I recommend that you consider that too when you read about them. Their war is terrible over there, and they're suffering for it. But I'm proud of my experience. I'm proud to be here. I'm proud to be associated with Jack. Jack and I want to say that briefly. We're navigators who nobody told anything, who never got any respect. We had trouble just keeping busy off when there was nothing doing. And Jack and I would go down to the link trainer. Anybody know what a link trainer is? Okay. A link trainer is a dummy plane that flies electrically on the ground, and it's not an aerial flying airplane. Jack and I would take turns getting in the pilot seat, pull the hood over, and fly on the instruments. Well, we didn't know how to fly in the first place. So the voice would come over the microphone: "You are now 200 feet below ground. Pull up." So what we did, those crazy things we did, were things that you did in combat to keep your wits about you. You couldn't think and dwell on what it was like to go on your next mission, and where were we going next? you had to pretend that it didn't happen. If somebody got shot down, as I did, Jack told me later when I saw him after the war, he said I had to be philosophical about that. And, you know, maybe I expected more from Jack as such a buddy, but that's what how we did it. You have to say, sorry, Joe, you're down. We miss you. We got to go on with our job.
He told me before we started, I said, what do you want to talk about? And he said, I was a trial lawyer for 50 years, so I don't have to do much talking. But I'm looking at some serious medals here, guys. I don't know if you can see this or not, but I see distinguished flying crosses. I see air medals with oak leaf clusters, and you proudly wear them, and rightfully so. Thank you so much for what you did for us.
Thank you.
I want to ask you this. We still got a few minutes here. What does being a B-17 crew member mean to you now? Do you keep up with your old buddies?
Well, they're all dying off. Jack and I are among the few that are left. My crew is all dead. So you became very close to those fellows because, for example, in the Navigator particularly, sat in the nose compartment of the B-17 with the bombardier, and we were there on takeoffs and landings. Well, the rules said get back in the back and go to the radio room and sit with your back against the wall. Well, we didn't pay any attention to that. We knew nothing was going to happen to us, and we did crazy things like that.
Tell them about it. Okay.
For the last 17 years, it's been my privilege to be a crew member on the EA's B-17 aluminum overcast. And I've been all over this country, and I've heard thousands of these stories, and what a privilege it is to talk to these gentlemen and thank them for what they did. Over in the Warbird area, right over here in the gift shop, these gentlemen are going to be there in a few minutes signing autographs, and we want to encourage you to join the EA Warbirds of America, all of you. You don't have to be a pilot. Just have an interest in the history and heritage of this country. Thank you so much for watching Warbirds in Review.